This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt and I'm in Melbourne.
G'day, I'm Warwick Long. I'm in Melbourne too, Rochelle. Usually I'm in Shepparton, but I'm just a swim down the Yarra from you right now at a United Dairy Farmers of Victoria conference. But we're not talking about that today.
Absolutely not. Completely far from it. We're looking at the idea of criminalising poverty today, Woz. So the idea around why we fine someone that couldn't afford something in the first place. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. And that could be from the homeless or just to those that are struggling to make ends meet. If you break the law because you couldn't afford something, how does a monetary fine make any sense? Surely there are other ways and other, I guess, solutions that can be put into place. So we're going to look into that today.
That's a really interesting part of the criminalising poverty debate, because it comes back to how do we punish people for doing what society sees is the wrong thing? And by doing so, if it's a fine, are we putting vulnerable or poorer people in our community into a spiral they can't get out of? I.e., is the punishment going to make their life so bad in such a way that they can't actually get out of that? Flow-on effects from things like bad credit, from fines, making it harder to find a home or work or to even travel to get those opportunities. It creates a cycle of bad debt and it can put people in a worse situation.
Absolutely. And we're seeing this rise in a bit of the middle ground as well. And we'll go into this today because there's been a rise in what's been labelled travel poverty. So this is maybe not being able to afford tolls, a jump in school kids that can't afford to get to school. Now, it is a crime to not go to school, but it is also a crime to travel on public transport without a valid ticket. But if you've got three kids all on concession, you're looking at anywhere around $40 to $50 a week to be able to pay for those kids to get to school. Now, rising costs and costs of living, we know, is front and centre at the moment. So that $40, $50 a week, when we're looking at everything else, that's a lot of money. So there are some solutions being thrown around by some of the community legal centres that you'll hear from today that looks at travel poverty. But just generally, was fines and where fines are in society, do they help us, or is it something that we need to rethink?
I don't have the answers, but I know many in our audience will have ideas and thoughts on whether fines are working and whether they're disadvantaging those who really have the least, or the most to lose and the least to give, I suppose, is the question on that. So give us a call. Are fines disadvantaging people differently, and are they putting vulnerable in a worse situation?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
Criminalising poverty, giving somebody a monetary fine when the law that they was breaking was not being able to afford something in the first place. When is it appropriate and when do we need to think about better solutions? Woz, let's bring in Melissa Hartam. She's the CEO, she's the Chief Executive Officer at West Justice Community Legal Centre. Melissa, this is a huge passion of yours and the work that your community legal centre does. Are fines criminalising poverty?
Yeah, look, what we see, and certainly in the western suburbs where we work, is that when you've got a fast-growing population like we do in growth corridors like Wyndham, where the pace of the population growth and housing is much faster than the implementation of all the social infrastructure you need, you have less emphasis on public transport, on housing services, education, employment opportunities. There's a significant rise in issues. And those issues include things like travel poverty, where people can't afford public transport, increase in fines generally, issues with young people feeling disengaged, and a number of other issues that impact people in those fast growth corridors.
There's a lot of interesting text already coming in on this. One about libraries, don't worry, we'll get to that. Another one, though, saying fines that don't adjust for personal circumstances are an act of class welfare. What do you think about that, Melissa?
Yeah, what we see is that it's really a one-size-fits-all with a lot of the systems where fines are imposed against certain behaviours. We have people that experience mental health problems. We have families that experience poverty on a daily basis. And when you've got these systems where there's one fine, a particular amount, families are expected to pay, and there's no application of special circumstances or consideration, then it's, you know, makes it very difficult for people to deal with the stress and address those problems that
because that's created. The system we have right now, isn't it? Most fines are an actual number that's regulated by government. It goes up a certain percentage every year, but whether you don't have much money or whether you are quite affluent, you're both paying the same if you do the wrong thing.
That's right. And the other challenge with it is that because of these issues, like I was alluding to at the start, where you've got systems that aren't really properly supporting fast growth areas and higher rates of poverty, you're going to find those groups of people with much higher rates of fines. So it's not just an inequity in terms of a person with less income having to pay the same amount as someone with more, but it's also the volume at which those families incur the fines, which not only increases poverty but criminalises poverty.
There's a text here saying my sister's minimal child support and her ex wasn't working. It didn't even cover their daily train travel to school. The system is absolutely broken. And another saying, make public transport free for kids to travel to school. That's from Joe. We'll get to that in just a moment because that's something that Melissa and her team have been working really hard on. Mark's in Shepparton. Mark, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Your comment before is with the fines on transport, public transport, I've seen the PSA officers jump on someone very hard, and the other token on side, I've seen them being very lenient. So I've got a bit of an open mind on that. But my main point I'm making is I think some of the fines when we had in the midst of our COVID crisis, you're looking at something more than $1,000 for not wearing a mask. Well, there's a saying, make the punishment fit the crime, but the politicians and the bureaucrats, they nearly need to sit down and think out what's a fair amount of money. And it's just gone overboard.
Is that hard, though, Mark? I suppose just the idea of how you feel in your values will decide the punishment to fit a crime would be very different to, say, somebody else and clearly different to those people in government. So is it hard to say make the punishment fit the crime? Well, it's easy to say it, but is it harder to make it work?
Well, I take your point on that, but there's no consultation. There's no regional... In America, they elect their own police officials. In Australia, there's nothing... There's no regional committees that you can go to and say, we need to discuss this. And they need to have set up some sort of mechanism that people can have some input into it.
I think
people like you and me have got no input.
I think you're right. And just going back to your point was, you know, the way in which COVID fines were implemented was very two-dimensional. It's no mask, therefore a fine. And we're not looking behind why someone's not wearing a mask. That's why during COVID, West Justice and a lot of CLCs and a lot of not-for-profits were really pushing for campaigns like Masks Not Fines so that we could encourage that positive behaviour. Handing out masks instead of fines would have been a much more constructive solution.
Yeah. Mark, thank you. And you raised some really good points. I mean, the fine for a mask isn't actually $1,000, it's $100. But Mark is right in the sense that I think for breaching COVID quarantine at the time, it was something like over $2,500. Mm. So those fines around the COVID period, I mean, some of that is actually just going through the courts now, Melissa.
That's right. And it's also assuming that someone's going to be able to pay for that at the end of that court process. Now, if we actually measured the cost associated with the initial contact and when the fine was incurred and implemented right through to the final hearing, if that person doesn't have the money to pay, those costs are unrecoverable. So the cost associated with prosecuting someone right through to court when you can't recover that money means that it's a zero-sum game for both government and the individuals involved.
The other thing that Mark mentioned, some very good points, Mark and Shepparton, but was looking at, is there a point or a period or is there a process where you can discuss this with someone, that where you can say, here are my circumstances, here is the reason why, and sort of justify your actions. Now, that's not saying that people should be able to get away and should be able to break the law, but surely there are different reasons. If you are breaking the law and getting public transport in order to get to a job interview or to get to school, does there need to be some leniency in some way, or is it just that all of those steps beforehand are broken, and where do you start with that?
Yeah, and I think part of the challenge is, yes, you can sit down and talk to someone about it and present your case. But for a lot of the people that we work with and a lot of the communities we work with, English may be their second language, or they may have difficulty with understanding the system, they really need a lawyer to help navigate that. And there's stress associated with you know, having to see a lawyer and having to explain your circumstances, having to put in applications. And then in addition to that, you've got everything else that's going on in someone's life. So really, you know, what's the point if it's a fine for something which is really just a consequence of someone not being able to afford to travel on public transport?
Melissa, I'm sorry, I keep throwing the devil's advocate questions at everybody in this, though. Doesn't, in your work at the West Justice Community Legal Centre, doesn't leniency favour the affluent, though? Those who can afford to spend a lot of money on lawyers, who can afford to spend the time to fight things like fines and charges, aren't they usually the ones that are more likely to get off than those who are less able to pay because they don't have the time, they don't have the money, they don't have the ability to fight fines?
Or even to know where to go for assistance.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Insofar as knowledge is key, you know, if you know how to navigate a system, if you know how to fill out the form, if you know how to get onto something early, you're going to be able to get a better outcome. Whereas what we see is often where people have tried to resolve it themselves and time has passed and fees have been incurred and further fees have been incurred. And by the time we see our clients, they're usually very large debts. And, you know, then they've got to navigate the system to get out of it. But on top of that, they've got other issues they're contending with, like mental health, health problems, trying to support the family, trying to deal with a whole lot of other issues in their lives. So, yes, it's a complicated system which I think favours people that are affluent over people that are poor.
Melissa Hardman is with you, the Executive Officer at West Justice Community Legal Centre. Rochelle Hunt and Warwick Long, and you're on The Conversation Hour. Looking at fines today, and who do fines actually benefit? From the homeless through to school kids and those from disadvantaged backgrounds for not having a train ticket, who does it help? Cost of living is front and centre at the moment. It's all we're hearing about leading into the election. And that middle ground of us that are starting to fall through the cracks, that can't afford to, that are reaching out because of food insecurity, maybe for the very first time in their lives. And food insecurity is probably a term that we hadn't spoken about as much, and how mainstream that's become. Is travel poverty going to become the next food insecurity, do you think?
The issue with travel poverty is that often, and if you raise a really good point about food insecurity, for the families that we work with, it could be a decision on any given week about whether I put food on the table or whether I top up a Mikey. And that's what we saw when we worked with young people on the Travel Assistance Program. That was a program that commenced in 18 on a very small scale and scaled up in 19 to assist over 260 kids travelling to and from school. And what we found was that kids were being held back from school sometimes because families couldn't afford to pay for the Mikey ticket. So by providing free public transport or prepaid public transport to young people at select schools over that period of time, it was 12 schools in the western suburbs for 260 kids, we found that not only was travel compliance increased, so only one young person got a fine throughout that whole 12-month period compared to about 25% before the project started, but also there was an increase in school attendance, an increase in wellbeing, decrease in stress. And that just sort of goes to show that if you actually get behind the cause of why people are incurring the fines and provide a solution that's effective by addressing that problem, you can create some fantastic results.
There's heaps of people on text already saying just make public transport for kids free.
Absolutely.
How, I mean, is that possible?
Well, interesting. We've been campaigning fairly vigorously over the last couple of years. And we currently there is a budget submission which we've put forward, which we'll find out about on Tuesday. And that is,
are you hopeful?
I am hopeful. And we the submission is to ensure that young people travelling to and from school that are financially disadvantaged or experiencing some sort of personal crisis are given an opportunity for free travel.
It just has to increase. I mean, if we just listen to the callers across the board on local radio at the moment that are struggling to make ends meet because of cost of living, I am by no way an expert on this, but you would have to, I don't think it's rocket science to know that this will have to increase.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we're certainly part of our campaign for prepaid travel or free travel for young people travelling to and from school is that they've missed enough. We are the state that was locked down more than any other place in the world, and our kids have missed so much school, and we really need to get them back into the classrooms. And if providing a young person with a ticket to get to and from school is going to get them face-to-face time with their teachers, we should be doing that. And this
so your submission is to get disadvantaged kids to and from school for free. That's what you're hoping for here.
That's right.
Should we quickly bring in Leah, who's called from Newport? Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling because as I was listening to you discuss the issue of fines, one thing that I've always found, this has happened for many years, say you get a parking fine, on, and quite a long time ago I did get one because I lost my ticket on the train. They will not allow you in that first instance to pay off the fine. Now, I've often not had the money to pay the $80 all in one go. You literally have to let it get to, I think it's called the parent court, before you're able to get a payment plan. And I've argued that quite a few years. Like, why? Why can't
So you can't
I?
Be proactive at all, proactive at all with that. You've got to wait until it's literally in the courts to get a payment plan.
Yes. And if I've said, look, can I pay off this amount? Say one was $80. I completely forgot time. It was within the last 2 years. I just didn't have the money, and they refuse. They say they don't do that, and that surely I can pay $80. And I found that really insulting, and no matter what I said, how I said it, it wasn't going to change. And I think that that is a significant difference. You may say, all right, fair cop, I did forget time, I didn't do something right. You wanted to make it right, but you can't, because you can't pay $80 in the time that they give you. They say, look, we can extend it a bit, but often it's because, look, I just won't have enough to eat if I do that.
Gosh, you're bringing back memories, I think, Leah. And for myself, you know, at a time when I just didn't have enough money and I got the fine, and I had, I think, the exact same conversation, and there are a lot of people that are saying similar things to you. Thank you. This texter says, thank you so much for doing this show. I can remember just how silly it seemed to me when I was 20 driving an old car whose rego was a couple of weeks late, and I was fined for that. Then I was saving the extra money for the fine and the rego. It just seemed silly. Emma King is the Chief Executive Officer of the Victorian Council of Social Services. Emma, I dare say you've been listening to a lot of this, nodding your head, because this is something that VCOS has been dealing with for years. Are you worried that there'll be more and more people in this situation as cost of living rises?
Oh, without doubt. We're conducting a listening tour across Victoria at the moment, and things we're hearing loud and clearly from communities is that impact in the cost of food, housing. We're seeing reports today around energy prices that will be going up quite significantly, and the impact of, as you say, public transport, or the cost of transport. When I'm mindful, I'm in Shepparton today, Warwick. I'm just thinking about the impact of whether
you leave town for a day and everyone's there.
And we're here a couple of weeks ago, which is that we were hearing from the local community, and they were talking about all of the very issues that have been raised here, and that real pressure and that precariousness of life in terms of how do you hang on to your rental property and manage to pay your rent, and at the same time put food on the table. And we know, going back to the work that West Justice has led in terms of making sure that we can have our students attending school and going to school, the work that West Justice have led has been phenomenal in demonstrating that we can tackle the problem, and we can do that at a relatively very low price. And what it means is we don't then have people caught up in the quicksand of our criminal justice system and getting fines. And we also have kids going to school, which is going to change their life trajectory.
Emma King's with you from the Victorian Council of Social Service. And it's interesting that you mentioned my hometown, Shepparton, but I feel like it's probably a lot of other hometowns. Emma King, if you want to see inequality, if you want to see evidence, I suppose, of people in poverty and trouble, is you spend a day at the magistrate's court in any of these towns, and you will hear cases of stealing food where people with either the threat or are going to jail when they're trying to feed themselves or get sanitary products or so. I've actually got an example of that we'll read shortly. But when we talk criminalising poverty from the work you do, do you have an example? Do you have things that you feel fit into that topic?
Oh, there's so many that fit into that topic. And going to the earlier conversation around looking at the number of people who end up clogged in our criminal justice system by virtue of the fact they can't pay their toll fines, looking at the number of fines that are given to people because they can't take public transport. So there's just, I think one of the challenges is there's so many examples, and we're seeing that a significant gap between people who are struggling to get by on welfare. And the earlier comments that I think have been made on this program around that there's no differential in terms of fines. If you get a fine, you get a fine, that's the cost. And if you're on $46 a day on JobSeeker, the reality of you being able to pay off that fine is about zero, let alone if you're a student, often on no income from a low income family. You know, there's just no way of being able to pay off the fine. So what we see over time is that people's fines accumulate because they can't pay for them. People end up in our justice system. It means that our courts are clogged with people who are trying to pay off their fines, when in fact we could come at this a very different way. And that's why I guess I'd go back to that the model that West Justice are pushing, which we're very supportive of, which is saying, let's look at the problem in the first place, and rather have people caught up in our criminalised system, in our justice system, let's look at actually what are some of the solutions. And a solution is actually saying to our school kids, let's make sure we can get you to school. We actually really want you to have an education, a great education. We want to support you. And actually, that's pretty easy and it's pretty cheap. New South Wales actually gives free transport to and from school to everyone. We're advocating more, that should be tailored to those who need it. But there are lots of examples of where issues like this are dealt with in a way that doesn't mean that people get caught up in our criminal justice system. We just look at actually how do we make sure we get kids to and from school.
Couldn't agree with you more, Emma. And, you know, on that note, you know, not only the human cost of being caught up in that system and the stress related to having to go through the courts because you can't afford to pay for something, but also the fact that the cost to government to pursue a fine or a collection of fines over that period of time, all the resources thrown to it, knowing that that person won't be able to pay it, means that you've got the loss to that person in terms of the stress and the effort and their own personal, expenditure that goes through with that, along with the fact that the government aren't going to recover the monies that they've invested in the process from start to finish.
And then there's the fine for not paying the fine, and then the fine for not paying the fine, and then how it just grows and grows. There's lots of texts coming in around solutions, saying that in Germany, they've come up with free public transport. In Norway, I think it depends on what you earn is what you pay. Paul's called. He's actually on the highway, I think, heading to South Australia. Paul, what's happening there?
Well, in South Australia, to the best of my knowledge, and I am a South Australian, I just happen to live in Victoria, school students can travel on public transport for free as long as they have a student card.
Right. And how long ago was that introduced, do you know?
I don't know how long ago it was, but I was in South Australia yesterday and I heard a teacher complaining because one of the railway lines is off being electrified at the moment, and he's waiting for it to come back on so he can take his children on excursions because they can travel for free.
It would make a huge difference, wouldn't it? I mean, some people are saying, well, it's absurd to be able to offer free public transport. A lot of other people, and we knew we would get this, saying, well, if you do the crime, you should do the time as well. Is it absurd to offer free public transport to students? It's happening in South Australia. I'm not sure whether you have any evidence of how successful that's been.
The point that you made earlier, which is that kids are required to go to school legally and they're required to travel compliantly, sometimes for families means that those two things are mutually exclusive. So, you know, what's the point in requiring kids to travel to and from school? And for many, that requires them to go on public transport but not make it available to them.
What's the cost, do you think, if a policy like this was implemented to let kids get to school for free, especially disadvantaged kids? Do we have an idea of what that would cost in terms of a government program?
Yeah, look, there's been some broad costings done, and what I can say is it's comparable to the free transport in the CBD. Mm. So whilst at the moment we're funding, you know, bankers and lawyers to travel free throughout the CBD, what we're proposing and what's in the budget submission currently with the state government is marginally more for this statewide expansion to kids travelling to and from school. And this, again, as Rochelle indicated, is not a blanket free public transport to school kids. It's qualified by issues such as financial disadvantage and kids in crisis.
There's a text here saying, you are brilliant for doing this topic. We've been called a lot of things. Brilliant is not high
That's
on the list.
That's a first.
Fines are absurdly high. No one is hurt by these crimes. I know too many students who come home sick with panic by the fines they've incurred. Thank you. And there is that stress, I could imagine. We're going to speak to a student wellbeing officer in just a moment. Could you imagine if you knew that your family was struggling and you knew that it was really tough and you had to be careful, if you got a fine, that feeling in your gut that you had to go home and tell mum or dad or who your carer that you got a fine on the way to school, it makes every hair on my body stand up. No child would want to do that. It would make you feel sick.
Let's talk some of the solutions now. People are sending in plenty of ideas, as you mentioned too, Rochelle. A couple of people have pointed out, Stephen included, saying, hi, ABC Melbourne, I think Norway has graduated fines according to income, from Stephen. To me, that almost sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare, but I don't know if it's possible or if it's easy. Emma King's still with you from VCOS. Do you have a preference in the idea of graduating fines according to income? Is that possible?
It is possible. It is done elsewhere. It is possible. Can I just jump back a little bit, if you'll forgive me as well? I did want to look to the point, you know, when people look at what's the cost of implementing, you know, free public transport to get kids to school, I did just want to touch on the cost of not doing it, because we know pre-COVID we've got about 10,000 school kids that drop out of school every single year. And without question, things like being able to get to school form a very big part of that. So the cost of not making the investment is also phenomenal in terms of the dropout or the non-attendance or absenteeism of students at school. So I wanted to point to that as well, because it often goes to the cost of investing in providing free transport for students to get to school. But I think we also have to look at the cost of not investing. And to get back to your question, I just wanted to throw that in. Yes, there are examples of looking at differential ways of applying fines, and it's just so blatantly unfair in terms of, you know, people on welfare payments, etc., being paying the same fines as someone on $200,000 a year.
Could that be a way to increase government revenue if someone on $200,000 a year is paying, say, a higher fine and we're charging less for people on lower income? I wonder where that would sit.
Yeah, it's a good question. I have to say, I've thought it more about from the equity point of view. And not maybe,
sorry,
I don't want people
here
to
I am
get
reading the numbers.
Well, I mean, how many of us, though, have had the argument that fines in some sectors, in particular, are red light fines or speeding fines, even though we know that they are there to keep people safe? So I am by no means saying that we should abolish those type of fines. But money-making revenue for local councils and or for government, we know that fines are a big part of that.
That's right. And look, just going back to Woz's point about the sort of the proportionate fines for people that have got access to more income, if you were looking at it from a financial equation, obviously by increasing fines for those that can afford to pay more, you're more likely to recover those amounts than heavily fining people that can't afford it, where the cost will be unrecoverable. So just sort of from a logical perspective, by scaling fines so that people that are least able to afford it are paying much less, there's more likelihood of recovery at either end of the spectrum.
Emma, we know you're busy. Emma King, the Chief Executive Officer at the Victorian Council of Social Services, of course, VCOS, you would know them, in Shepparton. The one day Woz leaves Shepparton, you tag team and enter in there. Thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
There's a text here from Vicky. It says, hi, folks. I totally get the discussion you're having, and things like free travel for students are no-brainers. But I have concerns about people accepting their responsibility as members of community. So it's about respecting parking restrictions and rules around driving. However, depending on the infringement, maybe some kind of community work, cleaning up a park, might be worth thinking about. My local community, I see people who seem to care very little about their impact on others, and this can lead to some pretty bad outcomes. I wonder whether there is a solution in community-led infringements. So, you know, people say you do the crime, you do the time. Well, maybe the time is to your local community. So that way maybe everybody benefits a little bit. Is that just me living in la-la land?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. First is why people incur the fine in the first place. So you've really got to look at the cause of the problem and how they found themselves in that situation. However, if you were looking at more constructive ways to address the problem rather than a fiscal penalty, then definitely there are other ways to approach a manner in which you can pay off fines. And you see that with the work development program, where you're able to pay off a fine by attending training, attending health appointments, and attending ways to address some of the behaviours that may have got you in that situation in the first instance.
Herbie's in Northcote. Herbie, you have a solution?
Yes. Interesting topic. I believe public transport should be free. We spend millions for bureaucracy, the ticketing machines, the inspectors, then the system, the court system, etc. We should charge a flat fee to every house, like the rates, and you would save a ton of money. You don't have to charge that much either, but you could also spend then the money freed up for inspectors actually there for safety, so people feel safer at night. So I think we are here for punishing people instead of looking at positive ways. So I think we got the head in the sand.
Herbie, some really good ideas there.
Can I add a small point? And I know a lot of people in regional Victoria will be shaking their heads at topics like this, because equity can come in a number of different ways. There's access to public transport is a major problem as well. So we should just point out, if public transport was going to be free, a lot of people in regional areas would be actually wanting some form of public transport,
yes,
in their town and between their towns and
but
communities
as well. But if
we're
talking travel poverty was for regional and for rural Victoria, the cost of petrol is going to come into travel poverty as well. So
hugely important. Regional people, by definition, are travelling a lot further to get to services and towns and communities. And also, some of the cheapest housing can be in some of those outside of a regional city, a smaller town, a community that may be a bit more run down, so to speak. And then you think you've got a great deal on the rent, but then you're spending a fortune trying to get to anything, and that affects the budget. And it means, again, what we're talking about, people don't travel to things, people don't do things, because if you've got to, you've got to pay for petrol, let alone the fine that may have been incurred over some form of your life, you get stuck at home.
That snowball effect, it's so big, isn't it?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria,
this is The Conversation Hour.
Are fines part of criminalising poverty? Are they making people spiral into a situation where they can't get out of? We're speaking about this today. We've been looking a lot at public transport fines, but it also invades so many parts of your life when you talk about the topic of criminalising poverty.
And are they a deterrent? You know, do they work? You either can't afford them and it's a huge stress and you get that snowball effect, or you can afford them and maybe you think, you know what, I'm just going to risk the fine. So on what level are they actually working? Melissa Hardman is with you, the Chief Executive Officer of West Justice Community Legal Centre. Samantha Sauerwine is the Head of Community Programs at Justice Connect. And Sam, you work, and your organisation predominantly works with those that are homeless or are facing homelessness. I will never forget in my early 20s almost having an argument with a ticket inspector trying to pay for someone that was clearly homeless, that couldn't afford a ticket, but they were just trying to get wherever it was. And I offered to pay for their ticket and they wouldn't let me. And to this day, I still have internal fights in my head as to how I could have made that happen. Where did the homeless fit into this, this conversation? And why on earth are we finding people that don't have somewhere to live?
Look, that's right, Rochelle. I mean, I think what we see really clearly, as you say, the statewide specialist service of people experiencing at risk of homelessness, is clearly the fact that people experiencing homelessness are some of the most complex and vulnerable people, and yet are most likely to be living their lives in public and come to the attention of law enforcement and therefore receive fines and charges really effectively that criminalises, you know, poverty and homelessness for them.
Sam, I've reached out to some contacts of mine that used to work regionally in the legal sector and talked about criminalising poverty. And I got back a bit of an email. I'll read a little bit to you. It goes as follows. When we talk criminalising poverty, I think the biggest one is how much less likely a person is to be granted bail without a fixed address, or for people who are homeless or are required to live in unsuitable housing, like rooming houses, public housing with high drug activity, et cetera, et cetera. It makes it really hard to assure a court that they aren't at risk of failing to come back to court or commit more crimes. It goes on further than that, and it finishes with, finally, if you have the money to pay for a lawyer, you can fight a charge as long as it takes. If you're relying on legal aid or other services, they have very limited funding to contest charges, so your chances and your choices become really difficult, and you could either end up representing yourself or in a situation where you have to plead guilty, which you may not want to do. All of these things, to me, criminalise poverty. End that quote. Do you see similar situations like that in your daily work?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's across the board, and obviously this criminal justice issue, I think, has been signposted by everyone here as being huge at the moment, and the fact that at the moment we are really relying on enforcement-based responses to what are social and, you know, housing and poverty issues. And we're using the system to criminalise people rather than actually deal with the underlying issues. I think, you know, coming back to the point about housing and how critical that is, what we're seeing is that, you know, this has been talked about, the fact that people who do have a certain amount of wealth are able to get out of the system, they can get lawyers. People who are homeless or the clients that Melissa's seeing at West Justice as well, you know, can't afford, you know, basic needs, and then are being fined and criminalised for that, and going through a court system that is already incredibly stretched and using resources when they're the people who can least afford to pay. So it actually doesn't make any sense.
Not to mention the pressure that's put on to organisations like the two that you both work with. You know, I was just reading the other day that one of the homeless services, it's like a phone service, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, so apologies, but they've had to pretty much shut that service down and turn off their voicemail because they cannot field the calls that they're getting. And then workers are arriving and there are people lined up. There are people, you know, I know that Brendan Nottle at the Salvation Army has had people sleeping in his cafe for years now. I mean, how does it put pressure on organisations like what you do at Justice Connect? Do you have the workers? Do you have the lawyers?
Look, I mean, I think we're all stretched in the community legal sector and really looking at how we can meet that increased demand. I mean, we've seen, I think, a 55% increase actually in people coming to us with fines over the last 2 years. And certainly, has been talked about before, COVID's exacerbated that because we've seen more people, once again, being fined for COVID-related breaches. And that's all coming home to roost now. It's backlogged in the court. And, you know, it's not insignificant amounts of money either. So we have about an average of $10,000 in fines for our clients when we look at it. And that's because a lot of the time you've got these fees attached. So the fines go up extraordinarily quickly because people can't do things early. And so it just means that people have this crippling debt, but also a real risk of ending up criminalised because of these original fines.
So yeah, that's absolutely right, Sam. It's Melissa here. What we find, like you, is it'll start off at a $80-$100 fine, and before long, once you look at the investment of the court system, the investment of state government, and the investment of the CLCs, you're looking at tens of thousands of dollars to get to a destination point where none of that money's recoverable, and that person's lived through that stress and that experience on top of everything else that they have to deal with. It just doesn't make sense.
There's a text here from Neil that says, fines are not meant to be equitable. They're meant to be a deterrent. I'm a traffic officer for a local council. Would you prefer me to start impounding cars instead of taking away people's independence instead? I do have sympathy for people on lower incomes. However, I have a duty to ensure that the road rules are adhered to. We've spoken a lot about the impact on students and the fact that they've, well, you know, they've been through hell over the last couple of years, and that we do want them to get back to school. That idea and that feeling you would have if you incurred a fine in some way and then you would have to go home and tell the person that it is that's paying the bills in your household. Teresa is from the Wyndham Council area. She's a student wellbeing officer. How often are students coming to you that are worried about fines that they're getting?
I quite often have a number of young people that are extremely concerned about the number of fines that they're receiving, and purely due to them wanting to get to school but not having the money, access money, to get them to purchase a MyKey card.
What sort of impact does that have on their learning?
it's a huge impact on their learning, because we found that students will be absent from school as opposed to attend school. Some of that's due to not wanting to communicate to anybody that they actually cannot financially afford to get to school. And we found that we have an increase in their well-being, their welfare, etc. So, yeah, very detrimental to all of them as a person.
What are those conversations like? Yeah, how much do you have to dig before you actually find that underlying reason, like, I simply don't have the money to get to school?
Well, at times, as you know, some young people are very open. Other times, it takes a fair bit of time and energy from us working at this particular school to actually find out the real reason of what's going on and why, they can't afford to get to school, or that they've received numerous fines because they are using public transport without the relevant My Kids in place. What I need to also say to you is our students don't wear a school uniform as such.
Oh, that's a good point.
So therefore they are not identified easily. And I can also say that we've been on excursions with our young people on public transport, and at times I actually find that they're targeted by the PSOs or inspectors. So it's like a beeline for a group of young people to check if they've got the relevant MyKey cards to use public transport.
So if the rules were changed to allow disadvantaged people to be able to get to school for free on public transport, what change would youth see in their lives?
A huge barrier that's taken away from them. I think it's imperative. I mean, our students in Victoria have had the worst couple of years ever. And at this particular time, we are trying to get young people or kids back to school face-to-face. And
we don't need any more. Yeah, we don't need any more barriers to make that happen. Teresa, thank you. And look, thank you for the work that you do as well. The fact that the kids at your school have got someone to go and talk to, that's so important. Teresa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
See, Teresa's from the Wyndham Council area. She's a student wellbeing officer, but it affects more than students. There's a text here saying, speaking of fines, I'm on a disability pension and recently having treatment away from home. My daughter and neighbour have been checking my mail. I did not receive my reminder for my registration and I was fined $909 for being overdue by 10 days. These sort of fines are crippling for people like me. I have never not paid my registration and I have a fine on the spot, sought for now for 30 years. I think it's just revenue raising. I mean, that's a huge amount of money. And that's when I guess being able to just have a normal conversation with someone and explain the situation as to why and how it happened. All logic just seems to go out the window.
We are speaking to Melissa Hardman, who is the Chief Executive Officer at West Justice Community Legal Centre. We've also got Samantha Sourwine with us, the Head of Community Programs at Justice Connect. Melissa, can I just ask a question? I know we are seeing, and Rochelle's already addressed this on the text, though, to you, that a lot of people, a certain type of person will be listening to this saying it's a bleeding heart conversation. These people realise that you need to set standards for a society to function and for it to work in a way, and that involves crime
rules
and punishment. And if you do the crime, you do the time. How would you address somebody who has those views?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Look, it's looking at the destination rather than the originating issues. So what I would suggest to that person is, to hear more of the case studies that we work with and the types of situations that lead people into a position where they incur fines. We had a young person who was attending university, travelling to and from university so that he could build a better life for himself. He had very limited means, and this was a real opportunity for him to create a career pathway and create an opportunity for him to have some sort of economic security. Travelling via public transport became unworkable because he couldn't afford the cost of public transport. So he borrowed a car and was travelling to and from by car, ended up getting fines because he wasn't able to afford the toll, the cost of the toll fareway. So, you know, building up fines from public transport, building up fines from the toll fareway ultimately led him to becoming incredibly stressed. By the time he came to West Justice to see us, he had significant mental health problems and had disengaged from university. I don't think they're the outcomes we want.
No, absolutely not. Craig is called from Kiwa. Craig, welcome.
Yeah, how are you going?
Good, mate. What do you want to say?
Not so much about the general conversation, but as far as the school students are concerned, where I live, and I'm assuming in the whole country, Victoria, if you got kids that go to a school in a particular cluster, the buses are free.
Yeah, it's more than 6Ks, isn't it? As long as you're 6Ks from the school, you get on the bus. Is that right, Craig?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. If you come outside of that, you have to pay. I'm not sure what the fee is, but it's not extravagant, I don't think. But my point being is I don't think that the school that my kids go to, their attendance is fairly high. They have good academic outcomes.
Because they can get to school.
So I can't see why they couldn't do the same sort of thing on a metropolitan public system.
I was just about to ask you that, Craig. So would you support the idea of doing it in the city?
Oh, for sure. For school kids, why wouldn't you? I mean, okay, outside of school it might be a little bit different. You might say, well, okay, you might have to pay to go somewhere, but certainly to get to school.
Yeah, during school hours.
That's a bad outcome if your kids aren't going to school.
Maybe the times that we have the 40K zone on is the times where public transport should be free for school kids. Good on you, Craig.
It's a good point, Michelle, but I would like to add that for young people, travelling to and from school is critical, but also travelling to sporting opportunities, to mental health appointments, to other things
that
a person might need.
This is why I'm not in charge.
To support them. So I just, you know, that's why obviously the campaign that we're leading is not restricted to and from school, but more about that young person's opportunities that will enhance their life and their experience.
And talking about where abolishing fines does work, Angela Savage is also the CEO. We've got some incredible female CEOs on today's program, but she's from Public Libraries Victoria. Angela, it wasn't that long ago that Libraries Victoria abolished fines. Now, this may seem kind of light and trite and whatnot, but when you actually think about the fundamentals of what a library offers and what its place is in our communities, abolishing fines was a huge step. How easy was it to get it over the line?
Well, I think there's a couple of things have been at play. The beauty has been the evidence base for the value of removing fines. So on the one hand, there's been the arguments around, you know, fines are disadvantaging the most vulnerable in our community. It's dissuading the people who most need library services from coming back to the library. It's meaning that books that could be returned are not being returned. So there's all those really valuable quality of life, social justice type of arguments. But also when we did the numbers, we were able to demonstrate to councils that it was costing them more to pursue and recoup fines than it was in actual revenue that was raised. So a lot of councils, when they saw those numbers, you know, were convinced. So we haven't got a blanket abolition of fines yet in Victoria, but more than 70% of Victorian public library services have moved to abolish fines, and we're seeing a real momentum in this direction.
Have you seen an increase in the use of the service because people aren't scared or they come back to a library whereas in the past they might not have because they're worried about a fine or a book they lost?
Look, Warwick, notwithstanding the impact of COVID on footfall in libraries,
it's probably hard to break that out.
We haven't seen a return to pre-COVID numbers, although we are running a campaign at the moment to encourage people to come back to the library called Return Yourself to the Library.
Nice.
But look, all of that notwithstanding, certainly in terms of returns of books, yes. We absolutely see returns increase when fines are removed. And if that's an indication, we could extrapolate from that yes, people are coming back to the library.
Well, I've just ventured back to mine and I am loving it. And I'm returning them on time at the moment. But the amount of people that I see in my library and how they use their library. So if it encourages people into a space that is safe through abolishing fines, I think it's incredible. Angela, thank you. There's a text.
My absolute pleasure.
There's a text here that says, I made a referral to West Justice for a man with cancer. He was on job seeker allowance. He had to travel to the hospital on public transport every day for 6 weeks for radiotherapy. He couldn't afford to pay his daily public transport on job seeker as well. So again, we're showing it's not just our students. It's affecting all people. Just finally, Sam Sourwine is with you as well, the head of community programs at Justice Connect. Sam, we don't have long, but, you know, we are heading into an election. I mean, what would you like to see change when it comes to equity for fines and for those that are already doing it tough?
Thanks, Michelle. I think there's a long list, but I'll keep it brief. I think really for us, it's about this idea of, you know, addressing the underlying causes why people might be getting fines or charges. So rather than, you know, letting people go through the system, let's work further upstream. Let's prevent it happening in the first place. And one of the key opportunities we see there, particularly for people experiencing homelessness, is a protocol for people experiencing homelessness in public places that helps police and law enforcement and local councils to actually better understand their role and to look at diverting into support services and agencies that can address the underlying causes of what's happening to someone, rather than going down fines and charges path, which, going to this deterrence point, doesn't work at all, and in fact just further criminalises people and costs the government and the community so much for an outcome that doesn't benefit anyone.
Samantha Sourwine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's the head of community programs at Justice Connect. Melissa Hardham, Chief Executive Officer at West Justice Community Legal Centre. We've spent an hour talking about this and it feels like there's more problems than solutions sometimes. But what's one thing you would like people listening to this to think about as we end this conversation?
I'd like people to think about the impact of postcode poverty. We've talked about travel poverty and other forms of poverty, but if you live in an affluent postcode, likelihood you got good access to health services, mental health services, legal services, and a whole raft of other social infrastructures that enable you to live a life that you have reason to value. And there's a lot of people that experience a lack of those services by virtue of the postcode they live in. And that's what we're focusing on today. People that buy no fault of their own aren't in a position to access the services that they need to have better opportunities in life, and that might be public transport, it might be you know, getting to and from a service that they need without having to pay some sort of public transport cost. So that's the image that I would like to leave people with today, that not everyone has the opportunities, and that leads to consequences which in certain circumstances are criminalising poverty.
Well, there's a text here from Jerry that says, thank you, this is such a fabulous subject. And it was actually your idea, Melissa. You reached out to us because we'd worked with you and your team in the past to look at today. So thank you. Thank you for raising that with us and for the work that you and your team do.
Thank you.
That's Melissa Hardham. She's the Chief Executive Officer at West Justice Community Legal Centre. Warwick Long, you're not in Shepparton today. You're just down the road in Melbourne. You're at a dairy conference, I'm guessing?
Yeah, dairy conference we're talking about today. That's an industry that has seen difficult times, but not right now. It's actually going through a lot of really good times.
That's it for The Conversation Hour today. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget you can always subscribe to The Conversation Hour podcast. You can go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and that way you'll never miss an episode and you can share it with your friends and family. And if you have an idea or someone or something you want us to talk about, you can email us, conversationhour@abc.net.au. We always read those emails. Take care and speak to you soon.